I was once an iron soldier, and I've been where the eagles call. I will tell of a shining city and how she came to fall.
My name is Henry, and I'd like to welcome you to Fortress on a Hill. My co-hosts and I are a group of leftist American veterans who scour the news headlines looking for stories related to the military and veteran communities of the U.S. But you're not going to hear most of the typical military tropes here. Here we take those same stories and we clear out some of the cobwebs and bullshit. We ask hard questions of our leaders and demand an end to the militarism that has permeated our society. We have a military budget of $750 billion, three times more than China, and seven times more than Russia. While here at home, American infrastructure and domestic policy languish, especially in the era of Donald Trump. However, Big Don is only the latest in a long line of presidential warmongers and bastards. Our country has lost enough to regime change and military operations the world over, operations that, by and large, only take innocent lives while providing no real protection from threats to our country. Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Niger, and the list goes on. It's time for a change. Thank you for being with us. Phil Kraske, welcome to Fortress on a Hill. Thank you for coming to talk about your book with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Henry. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. So I'd like to start by you giving us a quick overview of your book, 11-9 and the Terrorist Who Loved Bonsai Trees. And maybe if you could read a little excerpt for us, that'd be great.
All right. Well, the story is talks about how a young woman goes to work on the first day. She walks into her office, which is in Jersey City, New Jersey, across the street, across the river from Manhattan. No sooner she gets through the door than she's attacked, and the house converted to office. This place is full of paramilitary types. She manages to escape, and 20 minutes later, some terrorists who have just tried to put a bomb in the Empire State Building pull up to the same building. They run inside. There's a hostage standoff. And that's how the book starts. From there, it goes sort of between two different stories. One is the young woman, Trudy, who is running from the that are trying to catch her. And the other is the story of Paul Klippen, who's a diplomat in the State Department. And the hostage standoff in this building, which takes place when the terrorists arrive, this ends very badly for everybody. And America is, again, traumatized by a terrorist attack, and it seems that many of the terrorists were Iranians. So now America is beating the war drums against Iran. And of course, the young woman knows that this was a false flag attack because it was the building was full of paramilitaries and not terrorists when she arrived. And Paul Klippen, on the other hand, is trying to stave off this slide into a war with Iran. And the funny thing is, I wrote this book starting 7 years ago, put it down, picked it up. And the same thing is happening today. We have false flag attacks in the Gulf of Oman, and they're pushing America towards war with Iran. So I'm kind of smug about having predicted what was going to happen.
And well, you shouldn't be. It's easy for anybody who wants to see the pieces fall together, but it's also a lot easier to just dismiss them and take the take the established narrative for a run.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite true. But anyways, so I'll read a short from the band. You can hear a little bit about the hostage standoff and how that came about.
Sounds great.
So let's see here. Of further events on Charles Drew Street that morning, little need be said. All the world knows the story about how the five men entered the Empire State Building 9:07 a.m. on the security video and patiently went through security, little halo above their swarthy features. They rode an elevator to the fourth floor, the highest one of the base of the building that directly borders the sidewalk. This floor held an office that had been vacated a month before by a Norwegian shipping container representative. Security alarms had been taken out. There they forced open a temporary door to the space, opened a window on the 34th Street side, dropped a string tied to a weight out the window, and with the help of a Confederate down below, drew in two ropes, each heavier than the last. The second was a robust inch-thick cord that could have clutched a yacht to its dock. They drew up a smallish block and tackle and attached it to an exposed ceiling beam. With this, they drew up two of three wooden crates from the van, each big enough to hold a household air conditioner. Well, then they go to they flee to the house, and this is the hostage standoff. And from there, as everyone remembers, threats, bullhorns, telephone demands, panicked evacuations of surrounding houses, policemen crouching, reporters purring, tiptoes hurting, photographers squinting. Seemingly, reportedly, apparently, allegedly, all the wet nurses of modern journalism rose to the task of covering a life crisis. SWAT teams unpacked lockers, special teams stretched muscles, local police chiefs sipped bad coffee, the White House expressed concern. Chin-stroking specialists from every fife and specialdom gathered at each end of the 100 block of Charles Drew Street, where a little carnival of professionalism crackled and hummed, all at the service of the public good and the extinction of public danger.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that with us, Phil. Mm-hmm. So, as someone who has written about fiction about false flags and terrorism in general, I would imagine that your view of September 11th and what happened that day must be a vital one. Can you give us an understanding to what your opinion is and how it ultimately influences your writing?
Well, I was immediately sort of suspicious of the 9/11 official story for different reasons, and with time began to look into the alternative theories of what had happened, and looked at what the truthers were saying and what the debunkers were saying, and eventually came to rest on the side of the truthers, who say that the buildings were taken down with demolition explosives and have different theories about who was responsible and so on and so forth. I suppose that in a lot of ways, my view of these things is a lot influenced by the fact that I majored in international relations in college. And this was at the time in the late 70s and early 80s when there was still a great deal of suspicion of the government and how the real decisions were being made. There was still a great deal of questions of how we were getting it, why we got into Vietnam, why did it go on so long? So I suppose that I come from a generation that is naturally rather suspicious of foreign policy and the foreign policy machinery in general. And I guess that in writing this novel, I am writing about a dramatic situation, which is a terrorist attack. But on the other hand, a sort of a comic situation in which a sort of cabal of deep state types are putting together this plot. And my skepticism of the deep state and the people who make the big decisions is very much reflected in the book. As the title says, 11-9 and the Terrorists Who Love Bonsai Trees, it's sort of part drama and part comedy.
What kind of research do you do, and how long do you spend researching before beginning a book like this?
Actually, what I do, Henry, is I write the book, and then I figure out what kind of research I have to do. Sometimes I do the research, and I find out that I can't use an element or another in the book.
Sure.
So I guess that my research is sort of just germane to the book itself. In this case, I had to take a very careful look at the Empire State Building. I had to look at some just basic facts about different titles, different officials in the State Department. Paul Clippin, for example, he's the Deputy Assistant Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and that title really exists in the State Department.
Wow.
Deputy Assistant Undersecretary of State. And so anyways, I guess you've got to invent a title for every level, so that's what they do. different things. I even had to look into Jersey City. I had to walk down the streets on Google Earth, look at what type of neighborhoods it has, what type of houses, what kind of different electrical cabling it has, all kinds of things like that. And so really the point when I do the research, it's not to get every detail correct, but it allows me to present what is a feasible story. A lot of writers, especially thriller writers, they want to impress you with all of the research that they've done. And so they put in a lot of extra details that they don't need and sound very authoritative. But really, it's just a lot of malarkey. For me, as long as my story is feasible and based on fact, then that's good enough.
Sounds good to me. Now, this is, if I'm remembering correctly, this is your fourth book, is that right?
My fifth.
Right. Fifth book, my bad. So I'm curious to know, how did publishing your first book change your process? Most authors really have a big changeover following their first book. I'm wondering what your process was like.
Well, I wouldn't say it changed a lot. I published my first book and then immediately started to work on the second, published that very soon after. And I've always worked with a self-publisher, especially because it's very difficult for a new novelist to break into the business. All of the literary agents, they're all looking for the next, the next Harry Potter, the next Hunger Games, something like that. And somebody who comes along with just a good novel really doesn't get very far because, well, he's unknown.
Sure.
And people don't, you know, it's very much a chicken and egg thing. You have to sell a lot of books to become known, and you have to be known to sell a lot of books. And this is really the only book that I've been able to sort of publicize and, talk about because it has some sort of resonance with current events. My third novel, for example, is a romance connected with a thriller. And I think it's a romance that's on a par with The Biz of Madison County or Love Story. But, you know, I'm not going to get on your show to talk about a romance novel. And so, you know, it's been very hard to sell more than a few dozen copies of any of my books. Kind of a pity, but that's the way it is.
So, having studied false flags and terrorism more extensively, how do you think that we, aside from works like yours, how do you think we can best educate the public about false flag attacks, and what can we do to push back against that very strongly established narrative?
I think it's a very, very difficult thing to do. In fact, one of the points that I make in my book is that the truthers come along like the sand and shovel brigade, pointing out inconsistencies, pointing out mistakes, this and that. But they get very little attention from the public. And the same thing with 9/11. You have excellent research that has been done. You have scientists who are lined up saying, yes, the Twin Towers fell as a result of a controlled demolition. But in order to get any real push in the public is a very hard thing. One of the points that I bring up in my book, again, there's this one media man who makes the point that the official version of events is like the home team in a football game, for example. It automatically has the advantage. And it only takes an enormous effort to convince people and to get the word out in order to change minds. And I think that's a very difficult thing with 9/11, just because Americans in the first place are not terribly political people. They look at politics very much on the surface, and especially with matters of security or national security, foreign policy, they are really not interested at all. It's a pity, but that's the way it is. I would be very surprised if the truthers had any real impact in society. Maybe this grand jury that is going to be convened in New York would have some impact. But again, you know, it's a question of will the word get out, even if they come to a decision that you and I would like. I think it's very difficult. It's for the same reason that I criticize the argument that where people say, oh, 9/11 couldn't be an inside job because somebody would have talked. Well, what happens if they do talk? They go to a reporter. Probably a lot of reporters were quietly contacted after 9/11 by people who knew things. And so they listen to the person and they think, well, I've got a Pulitzer Prize for the taking here. And they write up the story and they go to their editor. And the editor rubs his neck and says, well, I don't know. I don't know if we can use this. And the editor says, okay, look, this is so revolutionary that you're going to have to come back to me with three sources, all of them willing to go on the record. And, of course, then the whole thing goes down the drain.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to get the alternative theory of 9/11 into the public to be debated seriously.
As someone who worked in the intelligence community, I think it's just hard when you're in the community, because so much of what you're doing is compartmentalized. So everything is, you're given a certain amount of information and you have to do your job with the information that you're given. And you can only push back against that at certain points, right? Like if you're working on an operation and or you're doing something that's like long-term information gathering, there's certain markers that you have to meet, and there's certain people that you'll want to know your progress and everything. And I think one of the best things I ever read when I worked at NSA was about the whole Iraq situation and just everything that happened with the WMDs and why everyone messed up. And it was because the administration was coming to them and saying, you know, hey, do this, find this. And that's exact. So then people, they were getting pressured to present a specific picture. And when that happens, it's hard to do your job right. Because instead of being asked, what do you have? And like, let's explore this. It was find this, find this, find this. And that doesn't create really good analysis. You can't actually do your job well when someone is telling you what to find. And when you have certain people that, you know, maybe they want to climb up the ladder and they want to listen to other people and say, oh, like maybe what the government or what these people are telling me is right. Then they, you know, they'll get listened to. And that really puts a lot, everybody else on like a backward footing where they might feel, wait a minute, like I'm a better analyst than that person and they're getting listened to. Why is that happening? And so then, you know, people's ego get in the way and it just creates like, and if nobody's there to check that, it can create a really bad environment where people are making decisions based on really shitty intelligence and or they're not listening to the real stuff and they're just going along with what they want to have happen. And that's that really doesn't do anything good for America because, you know, as you talked about in your book, you know, there's a narrative that's being pushed and everything that's contrary to that narrative gets swept aside.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets swept aside in the media as well, because, yeah. You know, another point that I make in the book is that the reporters who are talking about what's going on in, you know, the different events, they know what they can say and what they can't. It's not that there's somebody over them saying, do this, say this, don't say that. It's not that at all. They know what the newspaper or the networks line is, and they follow it, because if they don't, well, they don't have a job the next day. And you know, the man, when there's a crisis in the book of what the official story is, he tells the others in the room, don't worry, these guys are professionals, they know how to handle it. And indeed they do. But you know, it's like any institution at the end of the day. It's a hive of human nature. And that's one of the things that I try out in this sort of deep state cabal that directs operations. It's full of people who are essentially, interested in their own points of view, interested in one aspect or another. And, you know, it's a human organization and by nature has defects.
I think that's one of the things I really liked about your book was the fact that you were trying to show, you weren't trying to make judgment on any one person or any group. It was, this is what happens when people get together and there's a lot of emotion involved and there's a lot of things at stake. And people make decisions based on what they think is best for them and their group. And that doesn't always work out for the benefit of everybody.
Yeah. Well, that's why in the Constitution, there are all these checks and balances trying to balance the interests of each branch of government with their own interest of that branch. And it's the best you can do, but again, it's not perfect at all in practice.
The guys and I love doing the podcast. being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone, anyone who you think might be affected by it. Maybe a young person looking to join the military, or parents advocating for one, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment that the military creates for minorities and inflicts on them around the globe, and anyone else you think it might affect. Please take a moment and share this with them. Now, our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're very blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters, helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned here as an honorary producer, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as a dollar a month, you can keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I probably can't think of right now. So let's bring out our honorary producers, and they are Matthew Ho, Will Arenz, Gage Counts, Fahim Shirazi, Henry Zamota, James Higgins, James O'Barr, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, and Matt the Virgin Slayer. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if you'd like to contribute and Patreon isn't your style, you can contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/fortressonahill. Or check out our store on Spreadshirt. The great Bill Karpinski did a really awesome job making our first shirt, which you can find at shop.spreadshirt.com/fortressonahill. Make sure you check on the site there for promo codes before you order. And now, let's get back to the podcast. No, you guys talking reminded me of a quote from Three Kings, that anti-war movie with George Clooney and Ice Cube, and he was telling them about the, I think he called it the rule of necessity, as in people do what is most necessary to them at any given moment. And you can really see that in reading your story about that, you know, everyone is attached to something for entirely different reasons. How in the world that you find something that is logical or rational out of that is it's just bedlam.
Yeah, I think that's true. And also, all of these people have their own idea of what's good for the country.
Sure, and, absolutely.
You know, even the people put together 9/11, you know, presumably they thought they were doing what's best for the country. So it's always a question of, you know, a small number of very powerful people, many with the same view about things, getting together and being able to make events. That's what goes on.
So I wanted to ask you, you are an American expat now living in Spain, and I'm curious as to hear you share about why you left the States. I assume that, you know, some of your views played a role, but I'd like to hear you tell it.
Well, it's not that I huffed and got up and left the country at all. I studied in Spain my third year in college, and then when I finished my degree and things, I wanted to see the world. I spent about a year and a half in South America, in most of it in Quito, Ecuador, where actually my fourth novel is set in Quito, Ecuador. Then I came back to Spain because I liked it here so much. And I just stayed on. I like the lifestyle. I like the work I'm doing. I'm an English teacher, and I simply stayed. Being an expat is kind of a strange experience in a sense, because as an American, you know, you guys walk down the street and, well, you're an American like everybody else. But you're an expat and you go abroad and suddenly you're a representative of the United States, whether you like it or not. And the people that, for example, my students, I teach English in Spanish companies. I'm self-employed. I contract directly with companies for classes, executives and staff who need to know English or to improve their English. And I'm the, you know, the American, the only American they ever get to know well. And they always ask me for explanations about, for example, how in the world did America elect Donald Trump? And so there you are. You know, I haven't lived in America for 30 years, and I have to explain why Trump. And it's one of the many ironies of living abroad. But anyways, so it's also kind of a responsibility in a sense, because I represent the country to many people. And although I have to say that whenever I'm talking, you know, I speak Spanish fluently now. And but of course, I have an accent. And so I'm talking with people and they say, where are you from? And I say, oh, I'm from the United States, but I didn't vote for Trump. I have to add that very quick.
Just get it right in there, out in the open, right in the beginning.
Yeah, right. And then also with George W. Bush, also I had to say that. With Obama, not so much. Obama always had a really good image, and so with that, America's image definitely went up a bit. But with Trump, it's gone down. My goodness.
So I'm curious about how living in Europe has changed, or if it hasn't changed, your opinion, your own opinion of the U.S. and U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I guess that what has changed most is my view of the States, my view of the States as reflected by other Europeans. With Clinton and before that, America was respected and it was considered a friend. Many times a little bit heavy-handed friend, but a friend nonetheless. And then with George Bush, it went down considerably, and people really disliked America, even though they still respected its institutions. With Obama, the same thing, the institutions were respected and America itself was respected again. But now with Trump, the real difference is that America is just not taken seriously as a foreign power. People don't know what to expect of it anymore. They see the tweets of Trump, which of course are translated and put in the newspapers here, and people just don't know what is going on with the American presidency. Is this guy some sort of clown? Now he calls the president or the leader of North Korea Rocket Man. I mean that's childish behavior. And America had its defects before, but it was never childish. And that's what is happening now in Europe. That's how the image of the United States has changed. It's just not taken seriously anymore. And you can see more and more Europe and European politicians moving away from the United States as a leader. And that's a rift that is going to continue to widen, especially if Trump is reelected.
Absolutely.
We talked about this last episode, but I always think about just, you know, how much this administration and what's happening right now is going to affect our ability to move forward. You know, like what, because the bar is sunk so low, we like, what can we do now to rectify that, you know, in the eyes of our allies and our friends and everybody in the whole world, you know? And it's, I have the same thing, you know, when I talk to my non-American friends and they're, you know, just like, man, like the America's a laughing stock right now. Like we're laughing at you. And I'm just like, that makes me really upset, but like, I get it. I totally understand why.
Yeah. And the thing is that politicians in America are generally rather unqualified in matters of foreign policy. So it would be very difficult for a new president to be elected and to come in and really clean house in the State Department and really make a sea change in our foreign policy. For one thing, because of the deep state and the interests of the military security complex, that sort of thing. But also just because it takes an enormous amount of understanding of foreign policy, of other countries, of how the world works. And our politicians really do not have that. The last one that had that was probably George Bush the Elder. He knew a lot about politics and his handling of we were lucky that he was in office during the fall of the Soviet Union. He was and the fall of the Berlin Wall. I'm sorry. He handled that really very, very nicely. Before that, you would have to go back to Nixon, and before that, probably to Kennedy. But it's a very rare president that America has who really understands foreign policy and how the world works.
It's just, it's hard because we're so isolated in America, right? Like we're the cultural hegemon. So we put out all the media and stuff. And so when other countries, like every country knows about our music, they know about our films, they know about our food because it's everywhere because Hollywood is global, you know, but we don't have that same kind of exposure to other countries. And so when we're putting out all the media, it's easy for us to think, oh yeah, like we're the only country that matters, and people don't really get to see another aspect of that. And like, I think the number one thing my non-American friends tell me is I just wish that Americans learned more about other countries, especially countries that they're going to invade or going to like drop bombs on. Because we know nothing. I mean, when we went into Iraq, George Bush didn't even know the difference between the Sunni and the Shia and the Kurds. Yeah. He didn't even know that they existed. And a lot of people in the State Department like knew that, but you know, they're just, it's hard when we have people making decisions that are not fully informed on what their actions are actually going to do. And we don't foster a culture in America really of trying to understand where other people are coming from and why they make the decisions that they do.
Yeah, that's very true, Kagan. That's, Americans live in a very sort of island mentality. And, but you know, I'll tell you something. I think that aspect of American life is really getting better. I'll tell you what, years ago, when I went back to my town in Minnesota to visit my family and stuff, I stopped into the barber shop, and who was in the chair but my old math teacher. And so we talked a bit, and the barber said to the math teacher, "Did you know Bill's living in Spain now?" And the math teacher said, "Oh, really? Well, have you gone down the Amazon?" And so, but you know, and when I say to people in America, when I said that I lived in Spain, they were a little puzzled if that was in South America or just where. One guy asked my wife, "Now Spain, is that Spain, South America, or Spain, Europe?"
And
there are two of them, you know. But now that doesn't happen so much. And I that one reason is that American companies especially have more and more contact with other countries. Because yeah. I haven't found that sort of thing for a good 10 years now. Where is Spain? People know where it is, and they're much more aware of other countries just because other countries affect their business and internet and things like that. So I think that slowly is getting better. But even there, it's a slow change. And Americans, you know, well, like people anywhere, they are worried about what's near, and that's how far their horizons reach, really. So it's a tough problem.
Phil, if there was a book that you would recommend people read as far as trying to understand the story behind 9/11, what would you suggest?
I would suggest Greg Griffin's book, 9/11 Revisited. That really takes up the major issues and takes into account the major arguments of the debunkers and shows of why they're wrong, or at least answers them. That book is really quite good, actually. And Griffin writes well. He writes to the point. And doesn't get into technicalities too much. He's really a very smart writer.
Sounds great. Hearing everything that you've shared today has piqued my curiosity again. So I'm looking to see where I can best direction to head with that. Phil, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been wonderful talking with you. Will you share with our listeners where they can find your work?
Mainly on Amazon or any online bookshop. They appear on all the online shops. There's a Kindle edition, which is pretty cheap, and then there's the paper edition, which costs a little more. That's the best place to look.
All righty. And you also do post stuff at philipkraske.com, right?
Right. philipkraske.com is information about all my books, and I put my latest satirical poem. I write satirical poems about politics, international politics, this and that, and published them on my own website and on some others, and they're generally very well received. It's a lot of fun. That's what I write when I'm not working on a novel. I sort of alternate back and forth so I don't get too stale working on the novel.
Sounds great. Well, Phil, thank you for coming on. I hope that we'll hear from you again sometime soon.
Yes, well, thank you, Henry, and thank you, Kagan. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks a lot, Phil.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, and also at Facebook.com at Fortress on a Hill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, you name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
Listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not